Welcome to another episode of the Bengals Beat Podcast, continuing on this offseason with some special guests. And I'm super fired up because we have Bengals defensive tackle DJ Reader in the studio today, fresh off the practice field. Super excited to share the next 30 minutes, catching up with him, introducing him to the Bengals fan base. And he said he's an open book. Yeah. So I won't hold back. But DJ, thanks for joining me in studio today.
No, thank you for having me, Kelsey. I appreciate it.
All right. So let's just start this whole podcast off with your journey to the NFL.
Oh, it was long. I was a kid who didn't play much football probably until middle school. I spent most of my time, I played rec ball my first year. And I was lucky to play with some people who were super talented. I played with a guy like Keenan Allen, Chris McCain, a couple guys who end up playing Division I football. And it kind of really made me like the sport. Mm-hmm. But I spent most of my time trying to lose weight to make weight limits. So I was running around the field every day, a trash bag on, that type of vibe. And I couldn't get on it. I couldn't do it. So my dad just seen how much of a struggle it was. So I just played baseball until then. And then I got to middle school and really started liking it. Was able to play on the middle school teams because there's no weight limit there. Mm-hmm. So I really started enjoying it. And then high school was weird because I didn't win any games. I won like 9 games in 4 years. I tell people this all the time. So I played just a lot of baseball.
What position were you in baseball?
Pitched and played first base.
Okay. So what was were you any good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, okay.
Oh man. Well, that's all I did. Like, yeah, I was the man. I feel like I was the man. Right. I'd never say that out loud. Like in high school, I was super, I got very low key. I would never say that. But as an adult, I feel like I was a really, really good player.
What were you better at? Pitching or playing first base?
I was probably a better first baseman. Like I was a really good hitter. Like I
took pride in hitting. What was your batting average?
My senior year? Yeah. My senior year hit for .575.
Oh, wow.
I went crazy that year. It was a good year.
Oh, I would love to see some of that footage.
Yeah,
that
I got I think I got a clip on my phone of me hitting a home run. But I played a lot. I was homeschooled till 6th grade, so I ended up playing, just hitting off the tee all the time as a kid, all the time, just always just doing tee work. Doing it every day with my dad. So I just kind of knew my swing by the time I get older. And so it was just a lot easier for me. Baseball was. Football, just losing all those games just sucked. But on the baseball field, it was on me. Like I had a chance to control outcome on both sides. So I really enjoyed it.
So then if baseball was your main sport, how did you switch to football being the sport that you knew, okay, I'm going to go get a scholarship and then, okay, wow, I think I'm going to become a professional football player?
Football is like, if anybody knows like college baseball, they give out partial scholarships. Like there's guys who get out, get full scholarships, but they give out partials. And football is kind of my sophomore year. I started getting interest and a couple offers. We still sucked. I didn't feel like I was that good, but I played guard and I thought I was just going to go be an offensive lineman and play baseball. And so that was kind of the thing. I was a 3-star guard. I was going to be an offensive lineman, play baseball at the next level. And that was just going to be my way of going to college. Mm-hmm. I didn't think about pro ball at all. Like, pro sports just wasn't in my mind or my radar. Like, I watched a lot of pro baseball. So it was kind of like, if I had a chance to get drafted, I'd go that route. But pro football, I never thought about. Like, never even, I didn't watch much. I watched the Steelers, which is crazy to say out loud now as an adult, but I guess kind of the way they played the game at that point when I was growing up really made me like football. But other than that, like I didn't watch it.
Okay. So then how did you switch from a guard to Clemson making you a D tackle?
I started playing a little bit my junior year and I kind of liked it. I went to some camps and just got dogged still. I had no moves. I still got dogged. So I had no moves. So I kind of liked it. I liked how you could be aggressive at that position. You know, it was a little bit different. And playing offense, I feel like it helped me. Like, I kind of knew what offensive linemen were trying to do to me. And then, I don't know, a bunch of people recruited me as a guard, and Clemson just never did. Like, Coach Caldwell, even the offensive line coach, he was my recruiter. And I told him, like, you know, I wanted to play D-tackle, and he was like, whatever. Like, whatever it is. And I think some college coaches think, like, yeah, you can play that, and then I'll get you back over there. And I think I just kind of stuck when I got there. Like, you know, they like my film at D-tackle and they're like, you know what, we'll keep them here.
So when you got to Clemson, how long did it take you to become a starter?
We played I didn't start. I started my sophomore year a couple games, me and Grady did. But we rotated. It wasn't technically like starters when I was at Clemson. I came in with a bunch of guys who were sophomores. Mm-hmm. Like we might have had one senior on our senior class, on our defensive tackle, like as our group. And so everybody else is sophomores or redshirt sophomores. Everybody was young. So I was a freshman. They were sophomores. And we just all rotated. There would be groups of guys who started together. Like I was never a full-time starter at Clemson.
So then, well, you brought up Grady.
Yeah.
And I did want to ask you about that because for the listeners that don't know, I was lucky enough in Atlanta to get to cover one of DJ's best friends, Grady Jarrett. And for the rest of my life, I will be in debt to Grady because he was my first ever podcast.
Really?
I went to Grady couple years ago and I was like, look, I really want to do a podcast, but there's a ton of different podcasts out there and I feel like everybody's just trying to have a podcast and it's like I wanted it to be different. And I had like developed a relationship with him and his mom. His mom's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And I obviously wanted to do a podcast. And so I asked him and Alicia, I was like, look, I think this could be really good for your brand. Give you an opportunity to talk to the Falcons fans more. We can get some like celebrity guests on. And it was awesome. It was one of the coolest things I've ever done in my career. We got to like go set up his little studio in his house. We got guests like Dabo on. We got Jalen Rose on. Dansby Swanson, the Brave shortstop. Like we had such
a great name, right?
We had Ray Lewis, who was like, he's my favorite football player of all time. The reason I like football is because of Ray Lewis. But yeah, he's fantastic. And I know you guys are really good friends and you met at Clemson, correct?
Yeah, correct. Okay. We shared that journey of being like, you know, both not very recruited guys. Mm-hmm. Him being a wrestler, me being a baseball player, and just kind of respected the work. Grady's a hard worker, super hard worker. He pushes me, you know, on and off the field as a person. So, I think that was really it. And just always, you know, needing a friend that you can keep it honest with all the time. And I think me and him have special talks as men. And even back then, you know, just we couldn't have been more opposite off the field.
What do you mean by that?
Just told you, we just couldn't have been more opposite off the field. Like Grady was by the book, did things right, everything. And I was just not that. So whatever exactly like not that was, whatever you want to take your imagination to at that moment, like in life, I just wasn't that. We both had good grades. Like we always made sure we were good grades. We were students. And I don't know if pro ball was on his radar. On my radar, it definitely wasn't. It was just kind of, I was enjoying having a great time in college. Like I was just in college soaking it all up and
that
I was going to get my degree and be done with it.
But that's so wild to me now knowing both of you because you both are like two of the highest paid players when you signed your contract at the time at your position. So the fact that you guys in college, which was just honestly a couple of years ago, didn't think like that was a possibility is just insane.
Again, it could have been on his, but it wasn't on mine. It's not the way I thought about it. Like I had seen guys who I felt like, I wouldn't say my confidence was like super low.
Yeah.
I would say that like in my football game, it was at some point just because I didn't win games in high school. Like, I didn't know like what winning was or being like a good player was. I knew I played well. That was reciprocated with me making plays, but I also saw guys who made plays that came back, you know, right after going to pro and then came right back and didn't, who I thought were good players. So I didn't like, it wasn't something I was thinking about.
Well, so I have some questions about Clemson. Mm. I think I saw some renderings about like the facility. Is there like a slide?
Yeah.
Tell me about what it was like to be a Clemson football player.
Unfortunately, I haven't been back to see it, and I need to go back. But I've seen other guys talk about it. They got a slide that goes from the meeting room down to the main floor, I guess, where their lockers are to get ready for practice. It's cool. It's a good selling point.
So when you were at Clemson, who were some of the players that are in the league now when you were in school there?
I played with
– because this was like peak Clemson,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we were good. I played with Sammy Watkins. My freshman year, I played with DeAndre Hopkins. Played with Deshaun my senior year. Wayne Ellington. I'm sorry. That's a basketball player. Oh. Wayne Gallman, who else? I played with Christian Wilkins was on my D-line with me, Carlos Watkins, Grady, Deshaun Williams,
Dexter Lawrence?
Dexter came in the year after us, but I'm really close with Dexter. I still know all those guys. Austin Bryant. Mm-hmm. Cleveland was a red shirt when I was there. Hunter Renfro. Mm-hmm. T wasn't there yet. Ray McLeod was there. There's a bunch of guys. Taj is my quarterback the first year. Who else? Adam Humphries, he's still playing.
Wow. So many players. So
a bunch of guys out there.
Did Dabo he play a huge role in kind of your development, or was there a certain coach at Clemson that really helped you go from being someone who is, you know, kind of just doing football to have fun to maybe becoming like elite at your position?
I think Coach Brooks, him and Coach Venerable, Coach Brooks, my position coach, he really taught me, like, you know, the work, how important the work was. He was on us every day about the work. Mm-hmm. You gotta think, this is an old man who grew up in, whenever he grew up, but he used to just tell us about how he used to drive the school bus for the kids at school and then come back, get showered up, and then he'd go to school. And I'm like, or one or two showers a week. And I'm like, this dude is just rough. Like, he's just a rough dude. I watched him tear his Achilles and not have surgery until the end of the year. And he just taught us about the work. Every day he showed up, I knew how old he was and what he had been through and had all the crazy things he's just been through as a person. And every day he showed up to work. And no matter what we did as players, as people on and off the field, we were his players, and he took that with pride.
That's awesome.
So if we got in trouble, we were up, and he would be there, 5:30 workouts. If you had punishment running, he's there working with you. And it just kind of put that mindset of, you know, that's what it's about. No matter what your job is, it's the work. And then I think Coach Venerables.
Where is he, the head coach now?
He's at Oklahoma now.
Oh, right. Yeah. Big job team.
Yeah, so it's really cool for me. My son lives in Oklahoma, so I get to go taking the games and stuff still, but him just putting us in different positions and learning how to play wherever, him demanding a lot of you as a player, it really put a lot on your plate. But he made sure, like, you know, you were going to be presented every opportunity you need to show what you can do and see what's on film and being able to study and those things, different keys and things like that. You never felt unprepared for the test on Saturday.
I only know a couple of you guys, but if I'm just basing this off of production, it seems like Clemson is a really good place to learn, like, the life skills and everything that goes into being a professional. Like, it's very, I feel like, rare that a Clemson person kind of struggles to understand what it's like to be a professional.
Yeah, I think we got a lot of guys. Yeah, we got a lot of coaches that hold you accountable. Now, shout out my boy Mike Dubb, too. Mike Dubb was there. They hold us accountable in just ways of everything you do is pretty much on you, and there's no, like, hiding it. Clemson's a small place, so things that you do, that you get in trouble, those type of things, you got to be accountable for them. And I think there's a saying Coach Sweeney has, as best as a standard, and everybody holds to that. And that's on and off the field. You're trying to be the best person off the field. We do a lot of community work as a team. We do, you know, just how important it is to us. Religion is super important to Coach Sweeney and a lot of guys on our team. And a lot of people, you know, even if you don't have it, the importance of living by those rules every day or trying to seek something better for yourself, it kind of all kind of grabs you. And, you know, they make sure the coaches, they have their families around and people around. So they make sure they do a good job of keeping you tight as a person when it's some of the weirdest years of your life between those 18 to 20. Then you have a full-time job. They're asking a lot. So they try to keep you wound when you can really easily come unraveled. So I would definitely appreciate them for that.
So before I start asking you about your professional career and your journey to Cincinnati, since we're talking about college, and, you know, I haven't really gotten the opportunity to talk to someone who played college football at, like, a big time program. But what do you think about athletes being able to, you know, get paid now? Can you imagine what that would have been like for you guys at Clemson?
Yeah, I mean,
with the NIL,
I'm happy these kids are getting their money. Like, I think for years, you know, so much money has been made off the back of the college athlete that kids should be able to get their money. I just hope that kids know, like, just to keep the main thing the main thing. Like, I don't care how much you're making, what that number is. If you got a goal in life, you got to keep it there. Like, you can't let that money and things like that slow you down. And they will. Like, you know, I mean, you see it happen with guys on our level of that money just slowing them down. It just happens, you know, naturally. It's easy to let off the gas when your whole motivation in life might have been to get to a place to where you can make that kind of money.
Right.
And that's fine if that was your motivation. Do that to the best of your ability. But, like, if you got more dreams and aspirations, don't settle for what you feel like is the most money you've ever had right now.
I feel like it would be, you talk about the coaches that made an impact on you mm. then, but can you imagine being a coach now with social media yeah. being the way oh. that it is, and that, you know, these guys, like, being able to instill that work yeah. ethic every day when these guys really don't necessarily have to anymore.
I like pray for the college coaches. I say everybody always asks me, like, oh, you want to coach? I'm like, yeah, I coach at like the high school level. College, you got to, one, you got to recruit these kids. And I just remember how big of egos some of the kids who, when I was getting recruited, had. I could only imagine, like, the cameras in your face every day, people telling you how good you are, or either how bad you are every day. Mm-hmm. But it's just on you. The spotlight's on you. These coaches got to get on the road. They got to go recruit. They got to go do this and that. It just seems so tough. But, I mean, I guess you need people in those roles to help, or like, you know, build that in. And it's a lot.
Yeah. Well, I'm dying to go to a game at Death Valley. Because I heard at night it's up there in, like, the top environments. LSU and Clemson are definitely on my bucket list.
No place like it.
It's just hard with the schedule when we have games every weekend. Okay, so let's shift to after Clemson.
All right.
Your draft story. Tell us about what draft weekend was like for you and just kind of your first year of getting acclimated to the NFL.
It was cool. I was sitting there with my mom, my boy Wes, my brother Chris. And we just kind of chilled. Everybody, you know, I watched the first round. I didn't really watch the second round. And then, like, day three came along. I thought maybe there was a chance I might go in the second round. I thought, you know, coming off my junior year, it was a good year. And leading into my sophomore year, my senior year, I missed those six games. So it was a little rough on me. But, you know, I felt like I had a good combine, pro day, and I went to the Senior Bowl. I felt like I did well there. But I just remember just sitting and kind of waiting and just kind of sitting there and like, well, you know, maybe it'll happen. Then getting like calls in like the fourth round about, well, if you go undrafted, just think of us on your list. If you go and draft, like, damn, it's the first round. Like, y'all can't, I mean, it's the fourth round. Y'all can't be calling me. Like, it's three more.
I know.
Come on. Y'all got more picks. Y'all can still pick me. But, Houston ended up calling, which was crazy because that was like my shortest visit. I went on these visits in Houston. It's like, they didn't even know I was coming. I showed up and I was just kind of sitting there and everybody's like, oh, what are you here for? And I'm like, oh, they said I had to interview or not an interview, but the visit here. And then I, oh, okay, well, you got to go to physical. Well, I did my physical at the combine, so I ended up just waiting for like 2 hours.
Wow.
Just chilling. No, nobody said anything probably for the first hour and a half. And then finally, Coach Weave grabbed me. But back to the draft day, like, I was just sitting there, got that call from that 832 area code and just kind of was like, man, I hope, like, you know, this is it. Like, this is going to be it. Like, I'm about to get drafted. It's amazing. So I got drafted and went to Logan's Steakhouse with my mom and my friends.
That's awesome. Yeah. What was your order?
What did I get? I got cheese fries for my appetizer.
Love cheese fries.
And I got like the little chicken they have with like the cheese on top of it. I can't remember what it's called, but I get it every time.
So Houston.
Yeah.
You, what year was that?
When
you
2016.
Okay. So this was... Was this the defensive line of J.J. Watt and Jadeveon Clowney?
Yeah, they were both on it. J.J. got hurt that year, though. Okay. But they were both on the D-line with me, yeah.
What is your relationship like with J.J.?
I'm super close with J.J. We talk probably, you know, we don't get as talk as much as we used to. But we talk all the time just via text. We'll hit each other up, see what's going on. He's got a nice new house out in Arizona, so he always sends me pictures. But He's amazing. He's another person, kind of like Grady, who just always respected the work. His locker was right beside mine when I first got in the NFL, so I became real close friends with him. And just being able to talk to him about the work, what it meant to be a pro.
That's what I was going to ask you, and I'm glad you brought that up, because when you were young in your career, learning how to be a professional, having your locker next to J.J. Watt, where let alone from his actual skill set and what he can do on the field. Yeah. When you think of J.J. Watt, I feel like the first couple of things you think of is just like the hard worker he mm-hmm. is, the strict diet, those workout videos yeah. that are posted. And then obviously, and we'll get to it, but his community efforts, what he mm-hmm. did for Houston when the community really needed someone to put them on their shoulders. What is one or two pieces of advice that J.J. gave you that you felt like really stuck with you and helped mold you as the person and player that you are today?
Just to work hard. Nobody's going to care. Like, whether you're hurt, you're anything, like, when the way you feel about it has got to be what you go with. You know, nobody's going to care. You got to work hard every day. And the rent's due every single day. He showed me that. He's not just telling me that, him saying those words. He showed me that the rent's due every day. Hurt, rehab, back on the field, playing, rent's due every day. You got to go out there with intent to be great. You got to be intentional. Like, you know, you can't go out there and feel like you're just going to get through the day. You might as well be exhausted while you're out there. You got, you know, those hours and you get to go to sleep. And he's just always been on that. And you watch it. I watch him wreck practice. Well, you can't practice sometimes when he's out there. Like, he's just on that every day. And like, he's going to get on that scratch line in game, out of game, everything. I've watched that man almost die on the field, but all in will to get a win.
Right.
And, you know, that always meant a lot to me. That, and then the Wolverine blood. He's a, he's a big, big, big advocate for the Wolverine blood and how, you know, injuries are going to happen. People are going to get hurt and things like that. But there's always a mental aspect to certain things. And you got to be able to fight through certain stuff. There's certain stuff you can't come back off of, but everybody out there has some knickknack that's going on. You got to believe in yourself. And you, like, again, it goes back to the work. You got to work yourself back into that shape.
So you just teed me up for the segue that I want to get to next, and that is your injury.
Yeah.
So you finish your career in Houston. You mm-hmm. become a free agent.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you feel about free agents? Did you have any idea you were going to be coming to the Bengals?
No. You know, you want to be home for sure. Where you got drafted and what you considered right. home for those first couple of years. But, you know, I had my girlfriend kept telling me, she was like, you know, then you're going to go to Cincinnati. And she knows nothing about football, nothing about that from that aspect. Like, she watches, but she don't know nothing about Cincinnati. Never been to Cincinnati. Just a random thing to throw out there. And I'm like, man, yes. Anybody trying to hear that? Anybody going to the Bengals, man? You know, like, it's just something you never thought about. Like, Houston assigned me back. And then, you know, it's the COVID. It's the peak of COVID. Like, everybody's freaking out and everybody's in the house. Like, nobody's leaving the house. I can't go on visits or anything. And just the Bengals keep coming up. That's one of those names my agent keeps telling me. I'm like, dude, this is crazy. Like, this is insane. But my agent keeps talking to me about it. He's like, man, you know, and I had the D-line coach at the time, Nick Eason. I was really cool with him, just kind of talked to him, felt comfortable with him here, and just knew they were going to take Joey B, and just kind of took a chance. And, you know, as they say, the rest is history. Still been written.
Okay, so you just talked about, you know, getting here, but yeah. I think I want to start this next part of the conversation with you, and I want to spend some time on it. Your injury,
okay.
Your first year in Cincinnati, because I wasn't covering the Bengals at that point. So tell me when the injury happened, how it happened, and just like your first couple thoughts after you suffered that injury, because you know, you just get this massive contract.
Yeah.
You move your life to Cincinnati, you're playing yeah. for a new team, and then boom, your season completely ends before you basically even get a chance to make a name for yourself in Cincinnati.
Yeah. It was crazy. We were playing in Baltimore, I think the fifth game of the year, and it was just a routine play, kind of. I made a tackle, and one of my buddies who I played with in Houston actually was on the team, Christian Covington, kind of fell into my leg. I got up, kind of didn't think anything was going on, but I realized, like, I can't put my left leg, like, right all the way on the ground. And it's, like, super hot. Like, it's on fire. And I'm like, what is that? Like, what's going on? So I started, like, rubbing it. Somebody was beside me. I forgot who was beside me. I was like, yo, can you just put my foot on the ground? Like, help me put my foot on the ground. So I put it down, and it's, like, my leg, like, cramped up. And I'm like, I'm thinking it's just a cramp. I got to go get an IV. So I sit down. Doctor comes out. He's like pushing on. He's like, make a muscle. And I'm making it. But it feels like my muscle is like almost in my hip. Yeah. Like it feels like it's so far up there. And I see him like look up at me, look back down at my knee, like look up at me again. They call for the cart. And I'm just, at that moment, I'm like, damn, like it's over. Like it's, I just hope, like I'm thinking like, oh, I hope it's not ACL. Like, I don't know. I don't know anything about lower extremity injuries. Like I never had one. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, I just hope it's not ACL. I hear those suck. Turns out it's like way worse. It's a quad tendon rupture. And so that was just, I can't bend my legs for 6 weeks. I hear that's going, but I just more so disappointed that I'm not out there with the guys. We weren't having like the greatest year, but it was just about the guys, trying to establish that relationship with the guys. And then, you know, I commend the guys for, you know, letting me really take my time away and coming back because I wasn't around. You know, COVID was going on. I was in Houston rehabbing. I had my surgery.
Okay,
I was
so you just, rehabbed
in Houston. Yeah, rehabbed in Houston. So I just kind of checking in via text because it's just hard to wake up every day and go get those tests.
Yeah.
Especially when you can't move your legs. I'm about to be in the winter in Cincinnati. Cool. So it's just like, man, I just go and just be in Houston and just do what I got to do and come back. So that really... It was a lot on me. You know, I had a lot of people in my corner that helped out a lot. You know, my mom being there, her taking off work, you know, having my son, he's in the moments of learning how to walk during this point. So it was a lot of fun, you know, chasing him on a hobbling leg when he's learning how to walk and I'm learning how to walk. So, it ended up being a great time. And then I came back in the next year and all the guys are ready. And I was just excited.
Do you feel like when you suffer as significant of an injury as that, did you feel like it made you realize, you know, like you said, run is to every day that, you know, you never know what can happen with your career. Like, do you feel like it gave you a new appreciation for your football career?
I think I was always a hard worker. I think I was an intentional worker. Like I always wanted to get better, but I think just the injury helped me. They say it can be gone at a moment, but you don't know until something like that happens. And so it just makes you appreciate every single day of what you get out of here to go do. You get out here to go play a game that you truly, truly love every day. And so I think my off-season work just became that much harder. Like I had a weak point now. I felt like I was Superman. I never had a weak point. Now I got a weak point. I got something to focus on. And everybody else knows it. Like, you don't think those guys don't know. So in my head, I'm like, I got to defend myself. I got to build this armor. And I think that really kind of gave me a more sense of drive to come back. And I wanted to prove myself.
So I think one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on this podcast was because you, in a lot of ways, were kind of the building block for this defensive rebuild that's taken place over the last three years. Well, it is true. Because when you look at the list, obviously you were the first kind of – the Bengals previously, and Katie Blackburn even said, they've changed their strategy in free agency in terms of signing players from different teams. Yeah. And they're, you know, actually investing in free agents now. And you were kind of the first of that change of the mindset. Mm-hmm. And so you are one of the first players that Zach Taylor, under his new leadership, and Lou – you know, they knew in the AFC North specifically, we got to stop the run. We need someone who is, you know, can take control in the middle of our defensive line. And obviously, like Lou has said it a number of times, just how important you are. Mm. And then the draft of Joe Burrow and then T. Higgins. And then the following offseason, because you were already there, it gave them some flexibility to now go and spend on players like Trey Hendrickson, Mike Hilton, Cheeto, and then keeping in mind, you know, they had some guys coming along like Jesse Bates and Logan Wilson draft picks. So from you being here, and I know you were away from it for a lot of it, but from your perspective, to see this defense go from you might have been the best player on the field defensively to now you're surrounded by some guys with real talent. Mm. Like what was this year like for you kind of seeing it all come together from what you know you started with?
Yeah, you know, it meant a lot, like having guys like Sam and Jesse when I first came in that were here. You know, those guys were amazing. Josh, those guys, I didn't get to meet them yet, but like they were really good players. And then, like you said, bringing Vaughn and, you know, me and Mike Hilton and Cheeto and all these guys, Eli, everybody around, just you put a bunch of good football players around that believe in each other. I think that's the biggest thing to our defense. Everybody believes in each other. Everybody out there is smart. We have a bunch of smart guys on that defense, especially on that back end. They do a lot, but they communicate so well. There's no egos on our team. I think that was the biggest thing. Everybody came with a mind of change. So it meant a lot to me, you know, because I've been in locker rooms, or not necessarily locker rooms, but I've seen egos. I haven't necessarily been in any bad locker rooms, but I know how they could ruin a team. And I've seen it other places. I've seen people have good runs and egos ruin them. But when I came here, nobody had that. Like, nobody was up in arms about things. Nobody's up in fences, you know, especially the second year. The first year, things got a little rough and rocky, but that second year, everybody was eager to learn, eager to be here. Like, everybody wanted change. And so it means a lot. Like, you can't really walk in our locker room and divide us. It's too hard.
That was one of the first things I noticed when I arrived here in training camp. I was like, this defense, they kind of just seem like they all are about the same thing. And it's that you guys are all just very hard workers, that there's not necessarily one person. And I'm not trying to take any away from like the Rams, but like, for example, like Jalen Ramsey and Aaron Donald, and those are like really good players, but they also command like a lot of individual attention. And it didn't really seem like you guys as a group, you know, really had that one or two people that really kind of like go off on their own and are like kind of like the center.
Yeah, we really just care about as a defense, like how to get the ball back to the offense. That's it. Like, we don't.
We
don't even care what they, I don't know how many guys on our team really care what they have going on. Of course, we watch the Jumbotron and like see it, but I don't know how many guys on our defense even really care like what they got going on. We're cheering for them, absolutely, but we're just more so like, we got to get the ball back to them. Get the ball back to them. Get the ball. Stops, takeaways, however we got to do it, get the ball back to them.
So with that being said, I wanted to ask you this because I was listening to a podcast in which Matthew Stafford said that he couldn't watch the fourth down play in the Super Bowl when Joe Burrow got hit. That basically gave the Rams the win. Mm-hmm. What were you doing on the Bengals sideline when Joe Burrow and the offense had the ball, like in those final seconds? Like, were you watching? Can you watch? You know, what was those final seconds like for you?
Yeah, I'm a watcher. I watch. It's just, only time I don't watch is kicks. Kickers give me a little bit of the yips. Evan's a great kicker. I love Evan.
So you can't watch Evan?
I just don't watch the end of it. I don't, at end of games, I didn't watch the Tennessee game or the AFC championship. I didn't watch either one of those kicks.
Oh my gosh.
I still haven't seen them.
So what do you just like put your head down?
I just kind of put my head down and wait for the crowd reaction. I like do that like little kid peek where you're like, but like, yeah, I don't watch them. I don't know. I've seen kickers miss too many big ones, and it just ruined my experience. And I can't tell sometimes from the side if they go in anyway.
Sometimes I can't tell
if they go in anyway. So it's basically like I just wait for the referee's hands to go up. It's not like I actually see it go in or not. But so I don't really watch kicks. But plays, I watch. I watch plays. I watch Hail Marys, all that stuff. Like, just going to stare it in the face if that's what's going on.
So take me through hear mine when that – you see him, Donald's coming. And then Jamar Chase beats Ramsey on the right side of the field. If he had just one more second.
It's tough. I was still on the sideline, like, just livid from us giving up the touchdown, honestly, and just hoping that they could get out of it. I was still just kind of upset about the call and things that I couldn't control at the moment. But just more so, you know, that they're going to make a play. We're going to make a play. It's kind of what comes down to those moments. It sucks. This is one of the most humbling experiences ever, just losing a Super Bowl because
– you never know if you can get back.
Well, not even that part. Just more so like when somebody's going to be the ultimate happy. Like, you know, you went as far as you could, and then the other team's got confetti falling in their face after playing their hearts out. You know, it's
– and you get to come talk to the media.
And, and then, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and that's the thing. Like, you went as far as you're just basically the last loser and don't take that as like, I don't care. Like, I cared a lot. It meant a lot for us getting there. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it took everything we had, but it's just, again, it came down literally to the last play and then confetti's falling in your face of the other team's color. Like, it's probably one of the most humbling experiences in my life just as a person. 'Cause it's just like, damn, like you talk about like not, not you at an award ceremony and somebody else getting awards you thought you were going to get. Like, literally, the confetti is falling in your face.
Like, come on.
And every camera that you can imagine is running to your face to watch you have confetti in your face. And you can't react. There's nothing you can do. Like, you can't get mad. You can't be frustrated. You don't have any personal space to anything. You just got to walk and take that L and go into your locker room and hug on the people who you've been working with. It's not even like you can even get close to them. Everybody's in their face. You want to go across and congratulate the guys, but they're so happy. Like, it's tough. Like, you can't, how do you go over and congratulate somebody when you are so mad that you, I don't want to talk to anybody. Like, I don't, my agent, my mom, I don't want words from y'all. Like, I don't, what are you going to say? There's nothing you can say to me that's going to make me feel better at all. Only thing person made me feel better is my son. And that's just because he's just enjoying it. I just want to know if he was good at the game.
That's awesome. Well, so, but I want to ask you about the game before the Super Bowl, because I feel like that's a little bit more telling than the actual Super Bowl.
Mm.
You guys somehow escape your quarterback being sacked 9 times in Tennessee the week before, mm-hmm. in which that environment in Tennessee was incredibly loud. People don't bring it up in the lens of like Arrowhead or places like that, but it was really loud.
Yeah, I played in the AFC game. played there in the AFC South. Like, it, Tennessee fans love some Titans. Yeah.
So that game, even though they were number one seed, you're going on the road.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people picked you guys to win that game.
Of course.
Then second week, so Raiders, you beat the Raiders, then you go to Tennessee, and then you go to Arrowhead and play the big bad Chiefs, even though you had just beaten them a month ago.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people picked you guys to win the game.
Yeah.
Then they get off to kind of a hot start.
They were hot. On fire.
Like, Tyreek Hill was doing his thing. Patrick Mahomes looked like the old Patrick Mahomes, and it kind of looked like at halftime, all right, this might be the end of the Bengals' magical season. But I think a lot of people, because there were such low expectations of you guys, because nobody really knew what you could be, would have said, well, you know, if they lose to the Chiefs, oh, well, it was a great season. But then you guys go into halftime, and it was like a switch flipped defensively. I don't know if, I mean, you can say that the Chiefs kind of got away from what they were doing that was successful, but you guys also made some defensive adjustments, and then all of a sudden, you guys are right back in this game, and we're going down to the wire, and you guys are able to pull it out. What, in non-coach speak, tell us, what happened at halftime?
Guys just looked in the mirror. Like, that's just what happens. Like, guys look in the mirror, and we got a personal locker room. You can call each other out. We can talk to each other about what's going on. Like, every time, we're going to make sure we get it corrected. And things that we thought were going to happen, happened. Things that we talked about from their guys, from our guys. I can't get in specifics with you, but we knew that was going to happen. And that's what happened. Like, it wasn't anything magical. Guys just kind of stepped up. We made adjustments. I think we did a great job all year of making adjustments at halftime. The first 15 in the league is chaotic on both sides. It's always chaotic. Like, the first 15 plays can get – people can throw anything at you. But then after that, usually it's kind of football. Like, it's kind of, you're going to do what you're going to do. You're going to go back to what was successful, what you might have saw in the first half that might have been wide open that you missed. And that's just what's going to happen. Like, it's the nature of the game, and it's about who can survive those ups and downs and really make adjustments. I think guys really locked in, and we got out there, and once you get the momentum that first play is made, things have, okay, BJ catches that pick or things like that. Like, those things start going your way. It's nothing you can tell somebody who feels like, I'm sure you couldn't tell the Chiefs they were going to lose that game because they felt hot. When we got hot, we felt hot. There was nothing they could tell us about, oh, that we're not going to come back. There's no way. We done it too many times. Like, we've been in the camp grinding with each other. We don't, again, I keep reiterating this. We didn't have an indoor, and guys are out there competing at the highest level. Like, so there was nothing you could tell us as a team that we hadn't been through. I felt like even if we lost that game, people were just going to be like, oh, we knew it.
Yeah.
We knew they were fake. We knew they were going to lose. And so that was just kind of, I think that was everybody's mindset, and everybody came out there ready.
Well, I think that's one of the things I admire, and I know the rest of the media, they really like when they get an opportunity to talk with you because you just keep it real. Yeah. Like, and I think, like what you just said, did you think at halftime after you guys kind of came out and BJ made that play and it seemed like the game was starting to tilt a little bit more in your favor, did you think, okay, we had a chance to win this game, and then, like, did you think about the Super Bowl at all, or were you just so laser focused on getting the game changed in your favor?
So focused on getting the game. I knew we had a team, and that, in a sense of team, everybody believes in each other on team. The offense don't care what we have going on. When we come out there, you don't see Joe mad. You don't see anybody. When we come off the field, we give up a touchdown. None of them are mad. None of them are this. None of them are y'all can't. Like, that doesn't happen on our team. It's checked at the door. It's not for us to talk about them. And they're not to talk about us. We go out there and we really just believe in each other. And
where do you think that stems from?
Being competitive every week in practice and knowing what other people have going on. We see these guys throughout the week. We see T, Jamar, Tyler, Joe, all the, like, Drew, everybody. We see all these guys make plays on the regular. So why would we not believe in them? It'd be different if we didn't see it during the week of practice and we didn't practice hard during camp and compete against each other. And we've already put them through the test. We've talked crazy to them. We've had arguments. We've gotten in beefs, or one side feel like they're going to fight the other. Trey's talk trash to every one of our tackles that comes out there. Sam's gone hard against every right tackle that's out there. Me and Larry on the end like that. So there's nothing that, like, you could tell us about our team that we're going to believe. Like, we're not going to, nobody's going to sit there and, like, be like, oh, you say such and like, nah, you can't tell me Joe Burrow not the best quarterback in the league. I've tested it. And so it's for you to go out there and prove me wrong. I guess if you feel like that, now you got to test it. You say you've tested your quarterback. Well, I know what mine's done. I know I got the best receiver group in the league. So we're tested at DB. I know our running back almost ran for 2,000 yards. So we're tested on the D-line. So it's just about knowing that good on good is out there. Like, the O-line guys, we're tested. We're going to go against them. Like, things may happen, but they're not. They tough. They super tough. I know all of them are tough. And so that was really the thing, just believing in each other. And so I think that's kind of how it gets going. We get hot. We know they're going to go down to score. Like, we believe it. We saw it all year. There's one game that I can remember that they didn't. And that's gonna just so happen we lose the ball on a fumble and they go down and they score it in the Chargers game for 6. That's the only thing that stopped the momentum in that game. So, like, in my head, I'm like, oh, well, I watched this story. Like, as long as we keep doing our thing, we get hot, we do what we're supposed to do, they're going to take care of what they got to do.
Did you give that speech at halftime?
Nah, it's just, like, that's just how I really feel. I watch awesome. It. Like, you know, I watch it all the time. Just because I'm a competitor. Practice, I'm talking trash. Like, I'm not.
Who's your favorite offensive lineman to talk trash to?
Now I don't really got none. Not no more. I really talk to the skill position player. I like talking trash to,
like,
Joe
who?
Mix. Joe Mix. Joe Mix and Tyler, I'm always on their head just because they,
like,
talk all the time.
What do you say to them?
Oh, Joe, you know, I break through the line. I get to tap on Joe. I always just let him know, like, hey, man, that's TFL. I just want you to know. He's like, you wouldn't attack him. I'm like, Joe, come on now. You might run over these other guys. I'm not them. Like, don't play with me like I'm one of them, man. You see that 98 flash in your gap, just go to another one. There's no need coming over there.
Well, I have a couple more things that I want to get with you before we let you go. Really enjoying this conversation. I wanted to ask you about a question that a lot of people have asked, and I asked you about it in your first media session when you were back. But for those that don't know, listening, one of DJ's closest friends on the team is Jesse Bates.
Yeah.
And Jesse has talked so much about how much he leans on DJ when he's going through hard times, and just he spoke very highly of your friendship. You obviously know him and talk to him all the time. And, you know, this situation is, it is what it is. He's not here. I know you guys all really wish he probably was here. He's a captain. And, so there, for the people, the fans that want to know when there's a contract negotiation process happening, I think a lot of people will immediately go to the thought of, is this going to become a distraction for the Bengals locker room? I put out a tweet last week about why I don't think Jesse not being here and whatever's going on with the Bengals front office and Jesse will become a distraction for you guys, because I think what people are forgetting about Jesse, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is he's a team captain. Yeah. He's one of the most respected and liked players in the Bengals locker room. And in the day and age of player empowerment, like, you guys all want, and especially you know, you went through a gruesome injury. Like, this is, you know, life changing. And you said it, life changing money. I mean, I thought what you said about Larry was really interesting to hear, but, in an age where I feel like for most guys on the team, it's now like players want the other guys to get their money. Mm-hmm. And, I don't think, because of how Jesse carried himself all through last year when it was a really tough year for him, and just how much you guys like him, it'll be an issue for him if he's not here. But that's just my thoughts. But I wanted to give you the opportunity to kind of explain what you think of it and why you think that that fans that are worried about that shouldn't be.
It's probably the farthest thing from a distraction for us. Like, we all tapped in with Jesse. He's in group chats. He talks to us. We all talk to him. We want him to get what he deserves, and that is whatever he feels like it is. You know, he's a player who's played amazing. He has self-worth, and I would never tell a person to ever move on what they feel like they're worth, because it's you. You got to live with that decision at the end of the day. And I know he's working hard. I check him on Snapchat. He's up every day 5:30 working out. Like, he's committed. That's as committed as you're going to get. And he's doing the right things for his mental, and he's taking this time to really, as he should be around family and be around things. And like we talked about with the Larry situation, like, things aren't guaranteed. So, you know, you want to have that set in stone. I think, you know, he'll be around when he gets around. And I know he's not studying. He's one of the guys who watches film over and over and over. He's a football junkie. He's a sports junkie. Jesse loves every sport. He's a sports junkie. He's always around. So, it's something that I don't think any of us worry about. Not one of us. You know, he's a great person. He's a leader on the team. Like you said, he's a captain. I don't think our team really takes voting captains lightly.
Right. So to that kind of degree, I thought something that really should be talked about more is that, obviously, when the Bengals drafted Dax Hill, that was a topic of conversation. Like, is this, you know, Jesse Bates' replacement, or is this what happens if Jesse, you know, isn't here this season? And I asked Dax Hill a week later, I said, when it was rookie minicamp, I said, you know, who have you heard from? And he said, Vaughn and Jesse. And I was like, that, you know, kind of shows the type of person and player Jesse is. Like, all this outside noise about, you know, would Jesse be upset? You know, what does this mean? He's just welcoming in his new teammate who's going to spend a lot of time with.
I think he's going to go about it the right way. Right. You know, he's a pro. He's a real pro. And as a young kid, what, 25? He gets it. Like, he gets what it means to be a pro and be a personable person. And everything, you know, really about the sport. So it's just a testament to him and, you know, people who raised him. You know, they did a great job. You know, he's close with his mom, and he's just, you know, a great person. And that means a lot, you know, having, especially as a young kid who gets drafted, he probably gets feeling that smoke. Like, he probably feeling like, damn, they got Jesse. He probably not going to, like, fool with me or whatever. And for that guy to reach out and kind of lighten it on your shoulder, and, like, you know, Dax is going to be a great player. He plays multiple positions. You can put him out there at anywhere. So I think, you know, he's just a great guy to just add to the room in general.
Right. I know. You guys loaded up in the secondary, which I think is going to be interesting to see how that all comes together. But okay, so I'm going to now open it up to some of the fan questions that they submitted for you. So let me just pull these up. In the meantime, outside of Jesse Bates, if fans were able to walk into the Bengals cafeteria and eat lunch, or see you eat lunch, who is usually sitting at DJ Raider's table?
Probably Sam, BJ, and Trey, and Josh Tupel.
Okay.
Probably
D line sticks together.
I'll sit with the other guys. I sit with Joe sometimes, with Tyler too. So
Joe Burrow?
Yeah, Joe Burrow.
Okay. So you got a bunch of questions submitted, so I'm gonna try and fly through these.
All right.
Favorite food place in Cincinnati. Also, if he could share what his typical off-season schedule is like, vacation time, family, training, regiment, rest, etc.
Lucius Q and probably, oh, what's the dive bar like? With the wings, knockback nets.
Oh, I've heard those are the best wings in Cincinnati.
So good. The wings are so good. And off-season schedule, depends on if I'm with or without my son. My son gets up at like 8, so I'm probably earlier than that. He probably comes in the room at like 5:30. But he gets up around then. If I don't sleep with him, he come in that room by 5:30. So he gets in there about then. I don't wake up until like 8. I'm a 10 o'clock workout guy. I used to be a super early guy, but I like to spend that time if I'm with him to hang out with him before I take him to daycare.
How old is your son?
2.5.
Okay. And DJ, during the season, I think it was your bye week that you threw him a Shrek birthday party.
Yeah, we had the Shrek birthday
party. He's a big Shrek fan?
He's a big Shrek fan. He's in the Jurassic Park right now.
Okay.
And he just, oh, man. But he just busted his lip too at the Natural Science Center. So, he is a wild animal.
That I love kid, that.
He's fine. He was just eating popcorn right after he busted it. So obviously, it didn't bother him too much.
Okay, what is your view on how important it is in modern NFL defenses to have someone on the interior defensive line who can consistently eat up double teams and still make plays?
I think it's super important. The nose tackle position's evolving. They're asking you to do a lot more. You know, you don't just get to eat up those double teams anymore. You got to actually try to make plays after them. Mm-hmm. But I think it leaves room for great linebackers. You know, I got great linebackers behind me to go out there and make plays. So I think it doesn't work hand in hand. If you don't got one, you need the other. You need both of them.
What is it like being the best DT in the league? And if he would dominate at OG – like he did in high school.
Oh, man. I feel like I was putting paws on people. I'm telling you, if I was playing on the other side of the ball, it'd be bad news for guys like me. It'd be bad news. If I was playing on the other side, if I was still that guy, it'd be bad news.
What is the most rewarding and most challenging thing about being a father?
The most rewarding thing is I never felt like instant love. Like the love at first sight, like as soon as my son was born, like it's just like in love. Like I'll die for this person immediately. Like I shut my life off immediately, do whatever. And the most unrewarding thing, is that what they said?
Most rewarding and challenging.
Most challenging. My son is super headstrong. He is, I don't know where he gets it from. It's gotta be his mom because it's not me, but he is. Headstrong to the world. This is why he busted his lip today. Cause he is, I don't care what you're saying. Like, I can do this. Like, I can do whatever. So I think that's also rewarding the same. Cause I see how determined he is, but it is frustrating.
What was your favorite or most memorable play you had from last season?
My favorite play, probably the sack in the Super Bowl. I felt like it was a big momentum play. And, you know, I don't really get too many sacks on third. So it meant a lot.
I'm going to skip this question because I know you probably won't want to out one of your teammates. But someone did ask you, who on the team would you not let date if you had a daughter?
Yeah, I'll skip it.
Yeah, I mean, don't I can worry, answer I it, but I don't want to put you in a bad spot. Bunch of guys with one of your teammates.
There's a bunch of dudes on that team. I'm not letting date my daughter. None of them, actually. None of them. What? None of them.
All right. I have a question for you. It was a two sided question. BJ Hill.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, you're super tight with Larry.
Yeah.
BJ Hill gets his. Deal on here. Mm-hmm. I know you're probably super excited. You're going to spend a lot of time with him.
Yeah.
You're someone who gets to spend a lot of time with Joseph Osai today. It was really cool to see him sprinting like he was. How excited are you for those two guys to be playing next to you next season?
Oh, it means a lot. You know, BJ, he's a Carolina guy. So we get to talk a lot about just back home and stuff. He's a funny guy. He keeps the energy in the room, right? Uh-huh. And Lil Joe is what I call him. But he's a great kid, man. He's figuring it out. And it's amazing to watch him figure it out. He's eager to learn. He wants to be a great player. He works very hard.
When you saw him sack Tom Brady in the preseason, were you like, man, I think we got something here?
Yeah, I mean, I watched Joe when I was in Houston. Obviously, the Texas. Things that play on Saturday is Texas football. So I watched him a lot in college, and kind of when he got there, just saw how high his motor was for playing football. Like, he, in that preseason game, he gave it his all. Like, I watched him. You know, I've seen guys quit in the preseason, and all the young guys that we had last year, they were out there about to die, and none of them came out on the field complaining. They were having so much fun, just a great time. And so, you know, it's fun to see that in football, especially with young guys, because this could be overwhelming. You could get here and then lose all sight of what you got here on. And so he's one of those guys that hasn't lost sight of it, and he's just eager to get out there and play.
The last question I have for you is, when you finish your football career, whatever that is, what do you hope your legacy is?
Just a hardworking player, like a guy who's respected around the league. And I don't care about any accolades. I don't care about any of that. Nobody who's important to me cares about that stuff. Rocky not going to care. Like, and that's all that matters. So I just really want to be known as a great player, guys. Great player who worked hard, and a great father, a great man, more so than anything. Like, that's the respect I'm looking for. Like, my son's respect, my family's respect, and the people who I have around me, really. Like, you know, I got a bunch of family members that I really, really care about, and I try to show them the right way, whether I'm around all the time or not. But that's all I care about. That's what I care about, my legacy, because that's what my dad's legacy was to me. Like, he's my Superman. So I feel like I owe it to him to pay it forward on that end.
Well, I think you're going to have a lot of new fans after this podcast, because it'd be pretty hard to listen to this and not become a bigger DJ Reader fan. But I just remembered, and this question was submitted by your teammate.
All right.
Cheeto said, how did you come up with the Gravedigger dance that you do after sex?
Oh, the celebration?
Yeah, let us know.
I was in Houston, and I got to correct this. My boy Javon Hargrave is the Grave Digger. That's his name. I would never want to steal that. We were in Houston, and we used to, at lunch, we would go in our car, and, you know, it's camp days. The guy, four guys I was with, we would always just sit in the car and rap. And, you know, we got JJ on one side of our defense. We got Clowney on the other side of our defense. So nobody cares about the guys in the middle. Nobody cares. Like, we're just nameless, faceless people. Like, we're just there. Nobody cares. They try to hype us up. But you got – look at you, who you got on the outside. So nobody cares. So we just started calling ourselves, like, the Lunch Pail Crew. And I was just Grave Dave. You had DJ Dunning. You had, like, Julio was just Carlos. And I was just Grave Dave. That's just how it happened. And so I just started carrying my shovel with me everywhere. You know, we were just the Lunch Pail Crew. We just always went to work. And so we all got LPC shirts, and that was just like our thing. We would go in the car every day during camp, just sitting there, turn on beats and just rap and laugh at ourselves before we went back to meetings, and then nobody cared again. We went right back and just went back and just were kind of the crew. And JJ used to get upset. He's like, dang, I'm not in the Lunch Pail Crew. Like, I come to work every day. And I'm like, but bro, you got $100 million. Nobody's really calling you like the blue collar Lunch Pail Crew guy. Like, come on, man. And so that was kind of like the thing. That's where it came from.
Are you
going
to continue to do this? Are you going to change up your celebrations for sax?
I don't get that many to change it up now.
Okay.
Come on. Like, I'm not getting 10 now. If that happens, Mike got something for you.
Well, before I let you go, I got to get your NBA Finals prediction.
I got the Heat versus the Warriors, and I got. I want to say Warriors. I really want Jimmy to win one, but the Warriors are hot. So I'll go Warriors in seven. I'll make it a good series. I'll go Warriors in seven.
I hope it's a good series. Yeah. The series right now.
Actually, if it goes seven games, Jimmy Butler's going to find a way to win in the seventh game. I don't care what nobody says. So if Miami makes it, Jimmy going to find a way to win game seven. Miami in seven.
All right. Heard it here first from DJ Reader, his NBA finals projections. We'll see how this all plays out. But DJ, thank you so much for joining me. Wishing you all of the best this season. Hoping that you get a successful, healthy season and enjoy that summer vacation you get coming up soon.
Thank you. I appreciate it.